My name is Amy Dunn, and as this session's moderator as well as the presenter, let me introduce myself briefly. In my more than 20 years at the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment in California's Environmental Protection Agency, I've helped to design and carry out many innovative state programs, including state ballot measure, Proposition 65, starting in the late 1980s, all the way through today and Biomonitoring California, which I'll be describing to you briefly. In addition to my scientific work, I've also pursued an interest in risk communication. I especially value efforts that translate the findings of environmental health sciences into accurate and understandable messages that can inform action. And I think we'll be hearing about a number of those efforts today. I have no commercial interest to disclose. This is an overview of what I plan to tell you about today. I'll give you a little background on Biomonitoring California, then I'll describe how we've gone about developing the online presence to engage the public in the program, some of our successes and limitations, and then I'll briefly mention where we're headed next. Biomonitoring California is a collaborative effort of three departments: the California Department of Public Health, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, where I work, and the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Our enabling legislation specifies specific program goals, including monitoring environmental chemicals in a representative sample of Californians, conducting studies of targeted populations, subpopulations, and helping to assess the effectiveness of public health and environmental programs designed to reduce chemical exposures. We do this primarily by collecting data to inform those efforts. Biomonitoring California was created by legislation in 2006. The program had its initial funding in late 2007, which is when we held the first meeting of our scientific guidance panel. The panel includes 9 scientists from outside state government and meets 3 times a year by statute. One unique aspect of our program is the requirement to return all results to study participants who request them. So far, most, if not all, study participants have expressed interest in receiving their results. Involvement of the public was also written into the legislation. We are directed to draw on work that was done previously by the California Environmental Protection Agency with respect to environmental justice to make sure that our efforts to involve the public enable participation from all sectors of California society. Biomonitoring California is committed to carrying out our activities in ways that accord the highest respect and value to every individual and community by developing and carrying out activities in ways that promote equity and afford fair treatment, regardless of race, age, culture, income, and geographic location. Biomonitoring California's first 5 years, during that time, we've been focused on building laboratory capacity, selecting chemicals to measure, and conducting pilot projects. The scientific guidance panel advises us on all of these activities, but has been especially active in helping us to identify appropriate additional chemicals that are of high interest for measuring in California residents. One of the 3 pilot projects focused on pregnant women and included samples of umbilical cord blood after the baby was born. This project was done in collaboration with the University of California in San Francisco. Another pilot project is measuring chemicals in the blood and urine of firefighters and had environmental samples as well taken in some of the firehouses. The third pilot is being carried out in collaboration with Kaiser Permanente in California's agricultural-rich Central Valley. Our purpose in engaging the public in Biomonitoring California is twofold. We want to be able to convey accurate and understandable information to our stakeholders, and these include, for example, participants in our studies, as well as decision makers, such as those developing policies and regulations for the control or reduction of pollutants. Since consumer products are a source of many of the chemicals that are measured in people's bodies, we're also aware of consumers as an audience for the information that we're developing. We hope that our fact sheets will help individuals and communities to make informed choices. Finding ways to enable our stakeholders to contribute to the program's design and implementation is another aim of our public engagement efforts. Most of the outreach that I'm going to discuss, the methods we've used in the first 5 years, have been aimed at the second purpose of engaging stakeholders so they can contribute to the program's design and implementation. We began by carrying out public workshops and teleconferences to get the word out about the new program and help people to understand how they could become involved. Early on, we created a website, and I'll say more about that later. We also began using a listserv and building our list of subscribers. We've used this list to send out what I'm calling email blasts as a primary method for reaching those interested in the program. We've also experimented with using online surveys starting early in the program and found that this seemed to be a good way for us to engage many people and get their thoughts on what we're doing. I also mentioned the scientific guidance panel meetings. For these meetings, we invite people to come in person, but whenever possible, we're also webcasting these meetings to provide access for those living in other parts of our large state. People can comment via email both live during the meeting, during the webcast meetings, and at any other time, and we share these comments when they're relevant with our guidance panel. This graph shows a summary of the number of participants we've had in two different outreach efforts we've done, one in 2008 on chemical selection and the other in 2010 with regard to overall planning for involving the public in the program. As you can see, our online surveys have been a way to get input from more people. However, though the numbers are lower, those attending in-person workshops and participating in teleconferences have engaged more actively with staff, as that's allowed by these formats. We didn't hold any in-person workshops for the 2010 effort because of resource constraints. Online surveys have tended to be more efficient for us in terms of the resources used and what we get in return. With regard to our scientific guidance panel meetings so far, we've held 16 meetings, of which 9 have been webcast and 2 provided in a webinar format. It's for a total of 11 available to remote audiences. The distinction I'm making is by webcast, I mean video with slides and the speaker shown, but webinars only have slides. We also webcast when the facility where the meeting is being held has, we always webcast when the facility where the meeting is being held has the necessary technology. However, one of the buildings where we hold our meetings is in Oakland, and because of that location, we get more in-person participants, so we are balancing it off with in-person where we draw a lot of people and webcast where we can reach people all across the state. So of the various webinars and webcasts for which we have information, we've had approximately 30 to 70 participants joining remotely. As I mentioned earlier, our email blasts are the primary way we're communicating with our stakeholders. We use them to announce meetings and new web postings, including results when we have them. We send out about 30 notes per year clustered around the meetings. By tracking the number of notes that get opened, and of those, how many people click through to the content we've offered in the note, it's possible for us to get an indication of how our different notes are being received, including whether or not people are opening them. And it seems that the day of the week and also the time of the day has a big influence on whether or not people are opening the notes. Notes are much more likely to be opened when they're sent early in the day, and people seem to be opening notes during work hours, and sending a note on a Friday afternoon is a good way to make sure that it's not opened. This graph shows how our subscriber list has grown over time since the program began. And while the list is still growing, the growth rate has leveled out and currently is increasing at a net rate of about 2 per week. We're just beginning a new outreach effort that we hope will increase the list of those who are joining up. It seems like we've kind of maxed out of the people who have been aware of our program, so we're in the beginning of a new outreach effort. This is just an example to show you how the kind of reports that Constant Contact generates, which have been useful in tracking the responses to our email blasts. The notes shown here were all sent at a relatively optimal time of day and week, so the differences in response are related primarily to topic. Our open rate, the green line, is on par with the average for government agencies, the dotted green line, while the click rate, the orange line, tends to be higher than average. And as you can see from this chart, about 40% of the people who open our notes follow the links to the materials that we're describing in the notes. As I mentioned earlier, the online surveys have been a fruitful method for getting input from our stakeholders. Our first survey was carried out in conjunction with the public workshops and teleconferences when we were just getting the program started and we did everything we could to get the word out. That first survey on selecting chemicals to measure in Californians had a good response rate. We sent it out to about 400 people and got more than 300 respondents. But we're not sure. It may have been forwarded by others to a wider list of people. The two later surveys, both carried out in 2010, were sent to about 650 people and, as you can see, had a much lower response rate. However, in all of these surveys, we received extremely helpful information from people that we've used to shape our program. We're getting ready to initiate another survey soon with regard to the new website that we're about to launch. So our website is our main online presence, and as you can see here, at the top image is the image of our original site, which is still our current site, and below you can see an image of the new site that we're working on. The organization and flavor of the current website is based on what we've mainly used it for, which is to convey information about our panel meetings. The new site shown below is designed to appeal to a wider audience. The content display will be optimized for viewing on handheld devices such as cell phones and tablets. The new site will include interactive features that offer much more visual interest. This is an example of one of the features that will appear on the new website. We call it an interactive brochure. Work done to develop the hard copy brochure seen here on the left provided the original concepts for this feature, which we then expanded upon. The online brochure offers simple explanation of concepts such as what biomonitoring is and why it's important. At the same time, the web-based platform allows us to bring in links to more detailed information on various topics for those who are interested in digging deeper. We've designed the brochure to be easy to navigate, easy to read, and is fully accessible. It includes video content and plenty of photos. Some of the challenges we faced in developing methods to engage the public in biomonitoring California are figuring out what's working for us, both in terms of our success in reaching people and getting them to engage with us, and also making good use of the limited resources that are available. I've shown you one example that is tracking the success of the email blasts. Another important tool we've used is Google Analytics, which provides information on where people go on our website and how long they stay there, what kinds of devices they're using to access the site, and the for example, the number of people who are accessing the site with mobile devices has been growing quite a bit in the last 6 months. One very significant challenge, given our emphasis on online avenues of participation, is to make sure that we continue to offer other kinds of options that enable people who are not spending much of any time online to also engage with the program. Our in-person meetings and meetings by telephone are ways that we've attempted to create openings for these connections. As the program grows, however, we'll need to, and we are, continuing to explore other avenues as well to make sure that we reach those who are on the other side of the digital divide. Finally, it's been important for us to be picky about the technologies that we are adopting, as each one has its costs in terms of the time to use it well. Social media options, including Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, can be powerful tools for connecting with people. For our current needs, we've opted to focus on improving our website and have created a YouTube channel. Our information can also be shared through our department's Facebook page and Twitter feed. What's coming next is that we've begun to create videos with the hope that these will increase interest in the program as well as improve understanding of complex topics. The videos include subtitles in English that can be turned on and off. We plan to add subtitling in other languages as well. Our biggest new thing is that we're getting ready to launch our new website in early 2013. We're preparing to test the site pre-launch with a variety of audiences. When the site goes live, we'll use an online survey to gather feedback on the site, and that feedback will be used to improve the site. We're using the launch of the new site as an opportunity to reach out and expand our list of followers. We would like to find more groups who might be interested in hearing about the program's developments and our results. And we want to reach out to those people and have them engaging with the program so they're able to find out about these results when they come out. I'd urge those of you who are interested to sign up. You may have seen I've been handing out these postcards, and I have more up here, that invite you to sign up for our to be notified of the website launch, and so you can get involved with the program to the extent that you are interested. Or if you'd just like to give us feedback on our website, we'd really appreciate your input on it. The URL is there on the slide as well. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Lori Montserrat and Sarah Hoover, also other Biomonitoring California staff who have contributed to the efforts described here. And I'd especially like to thank Studio Warren, our web development consultant who is bringing our new site to life. Thank you for your attention, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have. So the question is about our new site, whether it will have information on the national program or other state programs. And we don't currently have that, but we do have links to the national program. So thanks for that idea. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Now I'd like to introduce Paul English, who will be presenting today on evaluating excessive heat warnings for public health sensitivities. Paul English is currently the state environmental epidemiologist and science advisor to the Environmental Health Investigations Branch at the California Department of Public Health. He's the principal investigator for the California Environmental Health Tracking Program and was a World Health Organization temporary advisor contributing to a systematic review of health indicators of climate change. Dr. English received his master's in public health and doctoral degree in epidemiology from the University of California, Berkeley. He has over 16 years of experience working in environmental public health for the California Department of Public Health and has published extensively in the peer-reviewed literature.